Good afternoon, everybody. How sweet to see so many of you here in the room. It's great. And online, thank you, everybody, for coming. Practice period is great. It kind of energizes us and gives us an extra shot of vitality somehow. Well, this afternoon, I want to start with something a little different. It's a quotation from a book by Shufi's husband. Shufi's our host tonight. Her husband, Morgan Meese, who writes about art. He writes great books about art. His most famous writing is a trilogy of books called The Three Paintings Trilogy. Three books. Each one is about a different painting. That's right, a whole book about one painting. And of course, it ends up being about everything but the painting too, all of it. So the second book of the trilogy is the one I'm reading now. I just finished it this afternoon. It's called The Fate of the Animals. And like all three books in the trilogy, it takes its title from the painting he's writing about. The Fate of the Animals is the name of the painting by Franz Marc. Franz Marc did this painting in 1913, just before what we call World War I, that he fought in and, in fact, died in. World War I, which was the first really terrible war, maybe the most terrible war that anybody had ever thought possible at the time. Now we know you can have even more terrible wars, but at the time it was the most terrible war anybody thought possible. So the thing about Morgan and why I'm bringing this passage up is that Morgan is a closet religious person, disguised as an art critic. And he's always looking for the religious content of the artist that he's writing about, which is not hard to find because fundamentally, at least as far as I can tell, art is always about religion, one way or the other. If by religion you mean, and this is what I always mean when I use the word, the fundamentally real, the fundamentally really important thing about being human, the essential thing. And I think that's what art is always about. So that's what Morgan is always writing about. How am I doing? How am I doing? Can you hear? No. Okay. You can't hear. Okay. So Morgan wrote a book, three books about paintings, and one of them is called The Fate of the Animals, and I'm going to quote from that one now. And in this passage that I'm going to quote from you in a moment, he is writing about this point, this fundamental point, which he says is the point of Franz Marc's painting. And in this passage, he's trying to describe what he thinks Franz Marc was trying to do. So I'm going to quote this passage, which is, I will tell you, one sentence long. One sentence long. It's one paragraph, one sentence, four full pages. And what it is a sermon by Morgan about exactly what we were learning last week from Suzuki Roshi and Awakening of Faith. How am I doing now?
Good.
Good? You can hear me? Okay, great. So he's actually writing about the same stuff that we were talking about last week. How the ordinary everyday world with all of its problems and quirks and tragedies is also at the same time identical to the Buddha world of perfection and the ineffable intensity of presence. And how, if we live without paying attention to that fact, we're going to suffer a lot because the truth is life is very hard. And so I'm quoting this to say that the point of this teaching that we talked about last week and that's in this passage is not just about Zen or Buddhism, and it even isn't just about religion. It's about life. It's about living. And that's why this teaching is important for everyone, regardless of what practice you do or don't do. As far as I know, Morgan does not and has never practiced Zen, although I don't think he will mind my saying that he is a very serious practicing Catholic. Anyway, and when I went to visit Shufi and Morgan, I visited his church, where he's some kind of something in the church. Anyway, this is a passage from Fate of the Animals. And if anybody wants to know, it starts on page 70 and goes to page 74. Fate, F-A-T-E, Fate of the Animals. If we are to take, and this is Morgan's words now, if we are to take Franz Marc seriously as a man and as an artist, and we might as well endeavor to take him seriously, if only for the reason that he took himself so seriously as an artist, as to cast everything else in his life aside, to beggar himself, as it were, in his life leading up to the Annus Mirabilis of 1910-1911, which is the year that he finally coalesced his painting technique, his painting life, to alienate friends and family in his pursuit of what seemed to them a pointless goal for a not especially talented man, a man who nevertheless relentlessly drove himself forward toward the point where, in fact, in the Annus Mirabilis of 1910-1911, Franz Marc did break through to creating an art that conveys the same Gestig qualities, Gestig is a German word meaning spirit, spiritual qualities, that he strove to produce in himself, and that drove him to live life in a relentless and sometimes terrifying pursuit of what he understood to be purity and to be truth, and which finally placed Marc in the position of becoming a soldier in World War I, a soldier who performed his soldierly duties admirably and with the dignity that, for him, was tied up with the purpose of a man going through life not wanting simply to see and to hear and to eat and to piss and to fuck and to die, but to do all of these things, yes, to do every one of those things, but to do so as one taken up into another realm of being, as it were, of having one's senses opened to the eternal that flitters at the edges of this pissing and eating and hearing, to open himself to the utter there-ness that can strike a person as that person inhabits a body and is at the very same time aware and not aware of that inhabitation, lifted up and dropped back down at the very same time, you might say, seeing the unity of all being, of all living things, while at the very same time being fully engaged with one's own specific and particular being, completely penetrated by love, as it were, completely overwhelmed by the unspeakable beauty of there being any being at all, and at the same time absolutely committed, as it were, to being the one specific being that one is, to participating in the grand cosmic tragicomedy as this one specific being that one is fated to be, and being willing at the very same time to throw this specificity away, valuing it not at all, and valuing it absolutely for the very reason that one values it not at all, and vice versa, and wanting to show in whatever way that one can, in whatever small and insufficient way, that this tremendous truth is in fact true, that the truth of valuing and throwing away one's precious subjectivity as the me creature that one is a truth that can be shared and shown, that the eyes of one's fellow human being can be penetrated with this truth, which is beyond the physicality of vision, but which tickles at its edges, and which can be hinted at and gestured toward, and which, for Franz Marc, was the only true and honest reason for there to be any art at all, any art of any kind whatsoever. There is only this one reason for it to exist, that the point of art, its only point, is to awaken and communicate and to share between human beings the tremendous strangeness and the overwhelming oddness of actually being alive. Actually and truly and really being alive right now, as it were, a realization that, when it is achieved, snaps you into the world, perhaps for the first time ever, snaps you in with the unaccountably odd sensation, the deep realization that one is both in the world, but at the very same time not absolutely of the world, that one is both oneself, a firmly articulated bit of individualized their stuff, and at the same time, that one is everything, that one is the totality, and that every moment of one's specific being is part and parcel of the total being, and that one can actually live in this mode, experience life and oneself in this mode, experience and surrender to these overwhelming truths and realizations, and have one's eyes opened. Have them really and truly open to what is really real, which is a truth and reality that is not beyond the real world, not outside of it, but is a truth that is hidden right there in plain sight, that is available for all to see, should they allow themselves to see it, should they put away the fear and the smallness that trickles into the lives of all, that weighs them down and sinks them into the world as if it means nothing, as if it isn't the strangest and most person-shattering fact simply to confront one's presence as a here being right now, and this bracing aspect of living as a person, truly alive and awake, gets covered and suppressed and dampened down by the fear of life, the natural unwillingness to see and utter, to see the utter strangeness of this and every moment of right now, a fear that leads inevitably into the suppression of life and the forgetting of life and the regularization of life, and finally to the forgetting of the fact that one has even forgotten, to the meanness and the smallness and the cutting up and the parceling out of our day-to-day experience, so that the magnitude, the sheer experiential magnitude of our actually being alive and actually being about to die at every moment is buffered, so that we cover ourselves and others in a suppressing and muffled layer of everydayness that becomes a protective coating, as it were, by which we suppress the power and the magnitude of the real truth of our being here right now. And it is the job of art, as Franz Marc saw it with every fiber of his being, it is the job of art to rip away the protective coating, to penetrate the layers of forgetting, and to bring us back, kicking and screaming if need be, to the real reality of being this creature who is not only a mass of flesh, but who is a geistig presence, a luminous cutting through space and time, to open up this spot right here and now, and to make this spot of what is otherwise only a being in potentia, as it were, to make this spot of being in potentia into being this, and to paint that transformation, to paint the full truth of really seeing, of really and truly having one's eyes open. This was the entire meaning and purpose of Franz Marc's life and of his art, or so at least it seemed to him. We can, that was the end of the sentence. We can, if nothing else, take him seriously in this. And we should take ourselves also seriously in this. So that's Morgan's writing. Not bad. Not bad, yeah. And the whole book is, that's probably the most outstanding passage, but there are many, many passages as good as that in the book. Okay, so that's my prelude to our going back to the awakening of faith. And
you're going to say something after that?
Yes. Yes, because it just goes on. Life goes on. There's no stopping point. We don't stand in awe. We just keep going. So I discovered that I was incorrect. I am often incorrect. And fortunately, now with the internet, if you do something that's incorrect, somebody will tell you from some faraway place. And I said that I didn't know of any English translation of a commentary to the Awakening of Faith. Apparently, this is not the case. There is an English translation of Fatsang's commentary is the most famous one, and it has been translated into English. Somebody named Jim Terp, who I don't know, but Jim Terp emailed us and told me this, that there's an English translation of Fatsang's commentary on the Awakening Faith by a man named Dirk, D-I-R-C-K, Vorenkamp, V-O-R-E-N-K-A-M-P. And if you have $279, you can get that book. I'm not ordering it myself, but anybody who wants to get it, it's apparently available. A little expensive, but it's available. Anyway, there is a commentary. Okay, I'm taking up where I left off last time, just with the invocation. Now I'm going to go on to tell you that the book, and a lot of this you probably already know if you looked at your book, but some of you I know are not. So I'll tell you that the book has five parts, four of which are quite short, just a page or two, and the third one is longer, constituting the main section of the book. So part one, reasons for writing the book. Part two, a very brief outline of the book. Part three is called interpretation, and this is the part with the summation of Mahayana philosophy. Part four is faith and practice, which talks about meditation practice, and it's a little bit longer, but it's pretty short. And the last part, part five, is encouragement of practice and the benefits thereof, which is also quite short. Here are the reasons for writing the book. There are eight reasons for writing this book, the author says. First, so people can practice and unhook themselves from suffering. Second, so people can understand the Buddha's teaching, which they need to do in order to unhook themselves from suffering. Reason number three, for advanced practitioners to increase their faith and understanding. Reason number four, for not so advanced practitioners to develop faith and understanding that they don't yet have. And the reason number five, to show people some upaya, some skillful means in order to overcome their difficult karma. Six, to explain how to do cessation meditation or concentration meditation, usually called shamatha, and how to do insight meditation, which is usually called vipassana or vipassana. It's a long story, maybe we'll get into it in part, but zazen is those two kinds of meditations collapsed into one practice. Seventh, to explain how to do a meditation of single-mindedly recollecting the Buddha, which is probably also what zazen is, according to Dogen. And eighth, and finally, to point out the advantages and benefits of practice so people will want to do it. You can still hear me? Yeah? Good. After the recitation of these eight reasons, our author uses the technique for the first time that he will use, or she will use, or they will use in the book, of asking like a question, making up a questioner who asks a question to clarify. So here comes a questioner, and the questioner says, well, those are nice reasons, but we already have all the sutras. So why do we need another book? A very good question that every author of a Buddhist book should ask himself or herself before writing. In fact, every author of every book should ask themselves, do we need another book? And seriously answer that question. Anyway, here's the answer that our author gives to that very good question. And this is, I'm quoting now directly, this is word for word what it says, at least in this English version. Though this teaching is presented in the sutras, the capacity and the deeds of people today are no longer the same, nor are the conditions of their acceptance and comprehension. That is to say, in the days when the Tathagata was in the world, people were of high aptitude, and the preacher, the Buddha, excelled in his form, mind, and deeds, so that once he had preached with his perfect voice, different types of people all equally understood. Hence, I wouldn't have had to write the book in those days. But after the passing away of the Tathagata, there were some who were able of their own power to listen extensively to others and to reach understanding. There were some who by their own power could listen to very little and yet understand much. And there were some who, without any mental power of their own, depended upon the extensive discourses of others to obtain understanding. And naturally, there were also some who looked upon the wordiness of extensive discourses as troublesome, and who sought after what was comprehensible, terse, and yet containing much meaning, and then were able to understand it. Thus, this discourse is designed to embrace in a general way the limitless meaning of the vast and profound teaching of the Tathagata. This discourse, therefore, should be presented. So, in other words, at the time of the Buddha, everybody could understand right away because the Buddha had some kind of power of persuasion that made people understand immediately. And then in later times, there were some people who could understand the sutras and even some who could understand without the sutras. But, he's saying in the 6th century, people of the present day have short attention spans. So even though there are a lot of sutras out there, it seems that we do need a short book to sum it all up for those poor people who don't really have what it takes to, as my grandmother used to say, don't have the sitzfleisch to sit there and read the sutra. So we have to have this book. So we think we have a crisis of attention, but it started in about the 6th century, we now learn. Okay, so now comes part two, the outline. So that was the part one, the reasons for writing a book. Part two, the outline, is a little murky, I think. What it says in the outline, it's very short. It says that the whole book, Awakening of Faith in the Mahayana, is basically an explanation of the word Mahayana. That's how the book is structured. It's structured as an explanation of the word Mahayana. And this explanation is divided into two parts. One part is called principle, the first part is called principle, and the second part is called significance. And that's the murky part. I think maybe it would be more understandable if you called the first part something like teaching about reality, and the second part practicing reality, because that's more or less what it amounts to. Now, I think I said last week that in the case of this text, the word Mahayana doesn't mean what it usually means, a school of or a collection of schools of Buddhism with a certain kind of teaching. Here, the word Mahayana means mind. It means the truth, the absolute truth of reality. That's what the word Mahayana means in this text. And we're learning absolute reality is going to be discussed in two sections, its principle and its significance. What it means, what reality is, and how we can live in it. So principle means, yes, good. Principle, so this is a good book, right? Very important. Principle means, is what the word Mahayana or mind, what does mind refer to? What does mind mean? It doesn't mean consciousness. It doesn't mean mental per se. It does mean reality with a capital R. And it has two aspects. Mind, reality has two aspects, relative and absolute. And the words our translator uses are not relative and absolute. He uses the words phenomenal and transcendent, which are pretty good words too, I think. Maybe they're better. The transcendent mind, the Buddha mind, the Tathagata Garbha, Dharmakaya, whatever, all these words are kind of synonyms. The transcendent mind is the essence, the truest true nature of reality. It doesn't come or go. It doesn't appear or disappear. It's beyond existence and non-existence. It has absolutely no characteristics, and it doesn't do anything. You might well wonder, well, why bother with it at all? You know, like, what's the point? If that's what it is, what's the point of bothering with it? Good question. In fact, most people don't bother with it at all. However, according to the Buddha and a lot of other sages, probably every great sage of every one of the world's great religions agrees that this is the most important thing that there is. It's the source of everything. And so, whether we like it or not, the truth is we have no choice but to bother with it. The thinking that we can dispense with it is how we have a life of suffering. That's the absolute Dharmakaya, Tathagatagarbha aspect of mind. The phenomenal aspect includes the transcendent, but the phenomenal mind, unlike the transcendent mind, does have characteristics and activity, which we can see everywhere we look. So to back up, principle or essence of mind, Mahayana, includes both absolute or transcendent as well as relative or phenomenal. And as we have just said, the relative, this is what the text is saying, the relative includes the absolute, but it appears, so far anyway, at least in this outline, that the absolute does not include the relative. But mind includes both equally, or rather, both as the same thing, because we're not talking about two different things. Reality is just reality. There's no two different things in reality. Reality is just reality. What we're talking about is ways to talk about reality. Hopefully, ways to talk about reality that will eventually lead us to find a way of living that reality that takes away our suffering. So that's why it's worth it to find a way to talk about reality. So that's the principle, division number one. The second great division of the book is called significance, which is a discussion of the literal meaning of the word Mahayana. The principle is like what the word refers to. The significance is what the word is in itself. So Mahayana. Maha means great. Yana means vehicle. You can still hear me, right? I hope I can last to the end of that. Yeah. No, but I want to be heard. I want to be heard. Okay. So, now it's going to talk about maha and jnana. The significance of the adjective maha in the compound Mahayana has three aspects, and now I'm quoting from the text, three aspects. Number one, the greatness of the essence, the transcendent. For all phenomena are identical with this suchness, and are neither increasing nor decreasing. So, actually, although things appear to be here and appear to come and go, actually, they don't. And everything, no matter how bad or base or trivial, is this absolute reality, this Buddha, which doesn't come and go, although it appears to our eyes and by the conditioning of ourselves as an organism, to come and go. Two, the greatness of the attributes. For the Tathagatagarbha, the Buddha nature, the essence of all existing things, the transcendent, is endowed with numberless excellent qualities. So now we're talking about the phenomenal world, which has attributes. Three, the greatness of the influences or the activity. For the influences of suchness give rise to the good causes and effects in this and other worlds alike. And this seems to be saying that all the goodness, all the good karma, and all the possibility, the bright possibility that we intuitively feel in this world, because we have all kinds of inspiring examples and experiences practically every day, all of that comes from Buddha mind, messages from Buddha mind. So that's the outline of the discussion of the word maha, the half of the word maha, the second half of the word jhana in the compound Mahayana. We use that word, it says here, because all enlightened ones have ridden on this vehicle, and all enlightened ones to be, being led by this principle, will reach the stage of Buddha. And this is the part of the book about the vehicle, about how to practice and how to live reality as it really is and how to appreciate it. So that's the outline of the book, which gives you at least a flavor of what the book is going to be about. On the one hand, a description of reality, a kind of praise song, really, about reality, designed to disabuse us of all the views of reality that we have that we don't even know we have that are holding us back. That's the maha part. And then some things we can do once we can appreciate that view. Some things we can live, some things we can do, some ways we can live, so as to put in motion in our lives the true reality that the first part describes. That's the jhana part of the word Mahayana. Okay, so that's part one and part two. Now, back to Suzuki Roshi. This is what I read you last week. I'm reading part of it again. This is page 89. We practice Zazen and other activities of Zen training in order to digest the knowledge of our Zazen experience to completely extend our realization to our everyday life, to the way we speak, the way we treat things, and the way we treat people. The rules of Zen practice are set up to help you to extend the Buddha way in your everyday life, to extend your realization to your everyday activity through the way you eat and the way you recite sutras. Even though you feel it is difficult, you will digest it more and more, and eventually what you do will help people, even though you are not trying to help people. When you come to this point, there's no Buddha, no layperson, no priest, no teaching. Because you have it, nothing special exists. You are always actually one with people, one with your friend, one with Buddha. So think of that passage in the light of what we have been saying, and also in the light of what Morgan is writing. Suzuki Roshi is saying that Zazen is the bridge between the transcendent and the phenomenal. That's essentially what he's saying, to use the kind of language that the Awakening of Faith sets up. Zazen is the bridge between the essential world of reality and the phenomenal world of what appears to be coming and going. And remember, there is no phenomenal and no transcendent. These are words which Suzuki Roshi almost never uses. He never says absolute and relative, because those words can be, in the Awakening of Faith intends them to be helpful, but they can also be just as much of a problem as a help, because you begin thinking that there's something that the word's describing. So here what Suzuki Roshi seems to be telling us is that by the process of doing Zazen, which is a process, that we do every day, that we do sometimes for a week at a time. In other words, it's not something we do every now and then when we have the time, because then it's not really the zazen that Suzuki Roshi is talking about. The zazen that we do as a way of life, as an ongoing practice, is the way that we learn how to live in the transcendent and the phenomenal at the same time as the same reality. That's not something we can figure out, because everything we can figure out is in the phenomenal world. Maybe we can't even notice that we're doing it when we're doing it for the same reason. But we can actually live it. We can actually make it real. And I think we can have some felt sense that we're doing that. Notice the word Suzuki Roshi uses in this passage. He says, realization. He uses that very word. Make it real. Zazen is the way we make our lives real. That's what Morgan was saying about Franz Marc. We make our life real. We extend, this is the Suzuki Roshi says, to extend our realization to our everyday life, to the way we speak, to the way we treat things, to the way we treat people. We do those things with a feeling for the absolute value and virtue of every one of them. This means that we're taking the transcendent feeling that we somehow sense in zazen, and we're extending it into all the time and into everything we do. And this isn't something that we force or we use our smart mind to work out. It's something that happens with our faith and devotion to zazen and to our practice. I told you that we were at Bopaya, whenever it was, just the other day, and we had a big brunch at the end of our meeting there, and everybody was asked to give a little speech of appreciation for our old teacher. And Kathy said, what I learned is I learned how to pick things up and put them down. She learned that from him, she said. I learned that you pick them up and you put them down with two hands. Because everything is alive. Everything is real, and everything is to be respected and cared for. You don't just throw things and think that things are not really alive. Everything is alive. And this is a particularly Japanese way. And Baker Roshi had lived in Japan and had a lot of his early teaching had to do with Japanese things. And it's a beautiful understanding and way that the Japanese, that's why there's tea ceremony and flower arranging and all those Japanese arts come out of that feeling. And that's one way we bring the transcendent into the phenomenal. And every day, everybody's got a lot to do with things. You got a lot to do with things every day. So you have a lot of opportunity to make reality real all the time with every single thing you pick up and every single thing you put down, because everything really is alive. And everything is awesomely worthy of respect. Suzuki Roshi says in that passage, you are actually always one with people, one with your friend, and one with Buddha. Being one with means you're completely absorbed with the person you're with. So you kind of disappear. There's only one there. There's that absorption. And that's why that person is always your friend. Because when you're absorbed in that one, that's what friendliness is. And that's why that person is always Buddha. Because there's full engagement. So you were never standing apart from your life. Think about it. You know, being alive as a person, the way we understand it, is standing next to ourselves, apart from our lives, waiting to see in every encounter, which way is the wind blowing? How do we do best for ourselves here and here and here and here? That's standing apart. Here, we're not standing apart. We're one with our life. And that's how we bring up the feeling of the transcendent. That's how we manifest Mahayana in our life. And what is Zazen, after all, but the simplest and purest possible enactment of the union of the phenomenal and the transcendent? Because this is a lump of human flesh sitting here with a bunch of organs. It's a physical body sitting here. It's the stuff of being a living being. It's the belly, it's the hands, it's the fingers, it's the shoulders, it's the eyes, it's the ears, it's the breath, it's the blood. That's Zazen. We sit there completely absorbed in that. And we, in Zazen, we do that with more intense awareness than we would at any other time. And so when we do that, we naturally let go of our self-cherishing, of our apartness, of our wants and desires, and we're just sitting there in the present moment of being alive. We're just sitting there in mind, in Mahayana, mind, body, world, right there. That's Zazen. And that's why it's such a sacred experience. It's the experience of sitting in the palm of the Buddha's hand, or God's hand. We're sitting Zazen in the hand of God. And we do it every day. You know, every day. It's not a big deal. We don't like stagger out of our sitting space. You know, we just walk out and make coffee. Yeah, because it's no big deal. There's nothing special about it. And anybody can do it. It's not just for special people. Anybody can do it. So all of this is just to say that I've been enjoying, and I hope you have been too, our sits these days during practice period, you know, the early morning sit and the bowing and the chanting. And the chanting and the bowing themselves, that's what Suzuki Roshi means in his passage. Those are practices that are the first way that we extend our Zazen into our daily life. By bowing and chanting and then making coffee and then talking to people and doing everything else. But it's bowing and chanting that are the first ways we extend. So I've been enjoying all of that. And thanks to everybody who's been attending. Thanks to the priests who've been doing the services, and to the Zoom hosts and everybody. I really appreciate it, and it's really quite enjoyable. So let's talk about Zazen in our groups. Let's talk about, so we're doing this for about 10 days or something like that, right? And some of you have been getting up every morning and sitting for two periods in the morning, not one. And how is it going? And are you beginning to notice spontaneously whether the sitting in the morning begins to implicate itself, at least for a few hours after you sit, in your daily life? So let's just talk about what we're experiencing and what it's like these first days of practice period. So we'll do groups of three. I think we have time for 4 minutes, each person, 4, 4, 4, 12, and 4, 16 minutes. Time to get in the groups and get out of the groups. So we'll come back in about 20 minutes. So you guys find your partners, and we'll do self-timing. Just use your own watches. 4 minutes each person, and then 4 minutes for discussion afterward. Thank you for listening.